Good morning, everybody. Welcome into Mining Stock Daily. This is your host, Trevor Hall, once again with our Friday long-form episode to get you into the last day of trading and into the weekend. It has been just a great week for the miners and even the juniors and the precious metals complex, the base metals complex seeing a bid. There's a lot happening. And so who better to come in and join us for some analysis on this other than Michael Oliver from Momentum Structural Analysis here. Actually, he's here in Colorado with us. So it was a great conversation with Mike. I will preface by saying I recorded this interview before these big moves in both gold and silver. And so you're going to want to pay close attention to some of the key price points he mentions in the interview. Because, folks, it happened. It's pretty encouraging. So we get into a discussion with Michael Oliver, and then we turn over to Doug Ramshaw, president of Minera Alamos, to get somewhat of a kind of a lay of the land here with Minera. It's supposed to be a pretty big year for Minera Alamos and the Santana project as it continues through its business strategy with its two other projects outside of Santana. A lot to cover with Doug Ramshaw, and so you're going to want to pay attention to that as well. Special thanks to our sponsors, Rio 2, Western Copper and Gold, Arizona Sonoran Copper Company, and Integra Resources. Thank you so much for your continued support of the podcast. Folks, if you wouldn't mind, please leave a review of the podcast on that network you are using to listen to all the content we put out here on a weekly basis. It does do us a tremendous amount of good getting in front of new investors. And trust me, there's a lot of people looking at this sector right now if this week had anything to say. All right, everybody, let's get into my discussion with Mike. We'll take a short break and then get into conversation with Doug Ramshaw. Thanks so much for a tremendous week, everybody. Have a great weekend. Be well. We're back here on Mining Stock Daily. I tell you what, I've got a great interview here with Michael Oliver, who's he is the guy over at Momentum Structural Analysis. He's been making some rounds here on financial media here in the last couple of years. And I tell you what, Mike, I'm really excited to share this discussion because we just kind of laid some groundwork of bullet points that we want to kind of talk through here for the listeners of Mining Stock Daily. They're going to get a ton of value off of this because before we kind of jump into the specifics of kind of these bullet point items we want to talk to, let's revisit kind of how you go about doing your research with Momentum Structural Analysis and really why your work is so much different than a lot of other people's work in financial analysis, specifically when it comes to hard assets.
Well, we look at price charts like everybody else does, but we look at them secondarily. Price is often misleading. Price action will often break trend lines that don't go anywhere, break out through ceilings that don't really aren't valid breakouts. What we look at is the momentum of price to make sure that the momentum action of the price action is reflective of the price. Usually momentum action of a market will tend to lead in trend change processes. If you're making a top, you'll start to see it in momentum first. Making a bottom, same thing, see it there first. How we plot that is we don't just plot the bars like on a price chart, but we plot those bars of price in their relationship to how much above or below certain moving averages. That doesn't mean we overlay the average on the price chart. That's meaningless to us. What we do is we oscillate it. So we get a zero line with where you're above it or you're below it, okay? We look at long-term momentum. We use such metrics as a 36-month average, a three-year average. And we can take it down to a three-day average if you need to, real short term. But we're focused mainly on the longer-term trend change metrics of any asset that we're looking at. In the case of the gold miners, of course, you don't just look at the miners. We look at all the ETFs, the major ETFs, the majors and the miners, like GDXJ, GDX, SIL, SILJ, and so forth. But we also look at gold and silver. So you have quite a few things to look at to put together there to come to a common conclusion. Well, we had an example recently. In November, we had action by gold to the upside. that told us that gold was likely seen its low in March, which we thought we'd, when the March low occurred in 2021, we thought that was probably the corrective low. And sure enough, since then, while it's been violent above that low, it's been above that low. Mm-hmm. Gold in November moved up enough to break out on quarterly momentum. Quarterly momentum meaning measured versus a three-quarter moving average, which is what similar to a 200-day, let's say. It was a structure on the momentum charts that it broke out above. But silver didn't join in. We had a number for silver that we wanted to see a weekly close during the last quarter in the 25s. Okay, it stopped one penny below our number on a weekly close. The peak weekly close knew where it had to either close above or not close above. It closed 1.4 cents below our breakout number. And since then, it's pulled back again into the low 20s. Right now, it's either side of 23. It's a new quarter, and that three-quarter average of silver has now dropped down to 24.44, I think is the number. Okay, so it's a buck or so above where the current market is. If silver can get a weekly close during this quarter up in the low 24 area, I won't get too specific here, that's for our subscribers, it's going to break out and join what gold did in November in terms of quarterly momentum saying, okay, I'm back again. I'm now coming out of this congestion that I've been in for a year and a half. Okay. So we're watching silver. Also, we're watching each of the mining ETFs, which also have failed to break out yet, but have numbers that are not far above on each of the mining ETFs that would indicate, okay, all this process we've seen since the summer high of 2020 is over, we're going back up. So that's what we look at. It's a different sort of measurement than looking just at the price charts. Yeah. And usually it'll give us a warning before you can see the evidence on the price chart.
It's very similar because I've been reading your stuff for a little over a year now. And it's from what you write, it's almost, you're like the captain of the ship. And for those that know, it's not easy to turn a ship, right? It's slow going. And your work really kind of sets stages of when that ship, aka the market, might begin to turn a little bit to the direction up or down.
Right. That's what we measure. We like gold. We think the situation that the world is now facing is unique for American history. Okay, I think we're headed for a financial crisis, a bubble breaking created by the Fed. Since the Fed's been in existence, one human lifetime and a bit more, a little over 100 years, it's created multiple monetarily stimulated boom bust cycles. You know, in the early, mid to late 20s, it created one by monetary growth, which most people don't know and understand, and it busted. We had a similar explosion of monetary growth at various times that created booms in the stock market and consequent busts. We think the bubble that they've created over the last 12, 13 years since their QE process began in 2008, 2009 is the biggest bubble they've ever created in that asset category. And then when it comes undone, and it's likely in the process of trying to do that right now, it's going to cause the Fed to basically go schizo, not just the Fed, but the ECB and the BOJ. That asset category, their stock markets, have been defended and defended. If they start to come undone, plus muni bonds, by the way, muni bonds in the US are now pressing at lows of the last year and a half, most recently since June, because of the Fed talk about tapering. They supported that market. Now suddenly got a muni bond problem. Corporate junk debt, high yield corporate debt. It's looking very toppy. These are assets that the Fed will panic if they punch a hole in them. And we think they're punching a hole in it. But the problem is once they get the unraveling begins there, it's going to cause massive asset reallocation, not just by investors, but fund managers. And it's already begun, I think, where a lot of fund managers have woken up and said, yeah, commodities are where you got to be. This isn't going to stop with the Fed. And sure enough, they're right. If you just stand back, if you're intimidated by this Fed talk, which has been underway since what, mid-June, the mid-June Fed meeting, gold has lost a couple percent since then. It's way off the lows that it saw during that June drop and four other drops actually since then. none of which could get it to a new low, despite all the Fed talk of tapering and raising rates now. Look at what just happened over the last, since the December high in the NASDAQ 100. It dropped 9% to last week's low, from the December high to so far the January low. The same time, with all the Fed talk of raising rates, the Bloomberg Commodity Index went up 10% during the same weeks.
Yeah.
So who's in charge here? The Fed says they're going to cut inflation and stop commodity inflation, yet commodities are going up. So we think that that talk needs to be sort of sidelined. Don't let it intimidate you, because if they punch a hole in their bubble, they're going to have to reverse that policy. And I don't know how they're going to do it, but they're going to have to, because it's a category they have to defend.
Have you ever had, have you, sorry to interrupt, just with this kind of inverse relationship between the NASDAQ and the Bloomberg Commodities Index, has a relation, inverse relationship like that, have you ever witnessed something like that happen before?
Yeah, in the late 70s.
Really? Okay.
The stock market had a major bull trend that peaked in like 73. And from 1973 on to about 1982, you could draw a line across the S&P 500. It was a wasteland for a decade. It went up, it went down, it went up and down, but net price, it went nowhere. And what did the commodities do from gold from its mid-1976 low, just above 100 after it'd been to 200 in 1975, it went up to 1980 and at $850, 7-8-fold move. Commodities engaged about a year later after gold turned up in mid-76. They turned up in late 77. And while stocks were going wasteland, commodities exploded. So that was a good example of the inverse relationship.
Okay.
And I think we're going to face one of those now, except even bigger. Because when you stand back and look at the Bloomberg Commodity Index, even just on a price chart, it's where? It's at 103. Okay, well, the low a year and a half ago was 50-something. Okay, so it's doubled. But if 103 is compared to 180 in 2011, so, you know, it's hardly blowing its lid off. It's just begun to emerge. And it's not just oil doing it. It's across the board with most commodities. So the Fed's not going to be able to stop this beast because they can create river flows of liquidity, but ultimately they don't direct where those river flows go. Investors do. And investor preferences are shifting. Fund manager preferences are shifting. And I think gold is going to be one of the prime beneficiaries. And I think silver will be the standout beneficiary.
If the Fed, obviously you and I know the Fed is stuck in a really hard spot here. So let's say they momentarily act that puts a massive correction in the stock market, their baby, and then they react from that by pumping more liquidity to protect the markets. Doesn't that in turn just create more inflation, which is what they're trying to battle now?
Yeah, it's the Fed has always had the major role of supporting government by buying their bonds, okay, right. Funding government in effect. Taxes don't really pay for government. You know, they're marginal. It's ultimately the central banks of Europe, Japan, and here that ultimately fund the government and fund other chosen select assets, much like the Fed did over the last year and a half by buying corporate debt, muni bonds, et cetera. So no, it's a process they won't deviate from for long. Especially if their bubble breaks. And we're measuring that as well. And our measurements say that we're probably in the process of about to do that. We've already had some indicators break down. We've got more to go. But once they fully break, we think the first consequence is likely to be something on the order of a 20% drop in stock market. Not a crash, not the kind of event that we had in March of 2020, which was 35% in 3 weeks. But instead, a normal commencement of a bear market, which is arduous in arm wrestling. But we think it could easily be 20%. Well, that'll scare the utter, you know, out of the Fed. There's no question. They'll have to somehow reinvent some new terms to adjust their policy, to explain away why they're, well, we can't taper anymore. Okay.
Yeah.
Gold, I think, knows this. Gold is the wisest market. It's been around thousands of years. The Fed's been around 110. You know, who's wiser? Okay. I think the gold market, and that's why the gold market is not collapsing despite 6 months of this stuff from the Fed. In fact, if you're a gold bear, you sold it at best around 1850 in mid-June. Well, you're making $30, you know, big deal. And meanwhile, certain other events are occurring on the sidelines. You know, the dollar's breaking down. Commodities are acting better than stocks consistently over the last several months, especially. And the gold miners are putting in what looks like a momentum base on the relative performance versus the S&P. So there's money flowing, beginning to flow into the inflation-sensitive areas, despite the Fed talk.
One of the things you had mentioned pre-recording was the spread between the GDX, which is the major mining ETF, and also the S&P 500. And we're at a very precarious spot right now. Can you explain to us what that spot is and why that momentum point is could have major implications, not only within the precious metals complex, but for people like me, degenerates like me, who put money into the miners?
Yeah. Well, if you just look at the spread itself. Now, the spread means let's divide the price of GDX into the daily, into the price of the S&P 500. You'll get a percentage, a very small percentage. Right now, GDX is 0.66%, less than 1% of the price of the S&P 500. Okay. If you go back into 2015, let's say, you know, when the gold bear was underway, made a low in late 2015, so did GDX, and see where that spread was then. Now, we're talking only the relative performance readings now, not the momentum of it. I'll get to that in a second. It was down around 0.6%. And if you just said, oh, okay, and you bought GDX then, well, GDX, I think, was like $14 or something, or 12, was it? And it went up big into mid-2016. You know, gold had a big rally, so did GDX. You made another low in, I think it was summer of 2018 in the spread. And again, it was down around 0.6%. The upper end of that spread reading for the last 4 or 5 years has been 1.3%. That occurred last summer of 2020 when GDX had the big explosive up move. It gained from about 0.6% to 1.3%. You say, whoa, big deal. That's a big deal. That's a doubling. You buy something at 60 cents and it goes to $1.30, you doubled your money, okay? We're back down at that zone again. And what's been happening to the spread? It's put its brakes on. In fact, the spread right now at 0.66 is where it was in September. So since September, the GDX has not lost any ground to the S&P. It's flattened. The spread's gone flat. So the spread has ceased to decline. It's near multi-year lows, which each time it gets there turns up. And when we look at the momentum of the spread, we measure that spread each week in relation to a 40-week moving average. 40-week average is, you know, like almost like a 200-day, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. We see the oscillator building a base, a very clear base that's even clearer than a stall in the spread action. If you looked at the momentum of the spread, you say, oh, that's a bottom. Okay. If you uptick that spread much above 0.7%, and again, it's at 0.66, so you get a little 0.5% rise in the spread, let's say. Tenth of a percent rise, excuse me. You're going to break momentum out to the upside. The last time that momentum action did the same thing was shortly after the March 2020 low. If you recall, that was when the GDX puked for 3 or 4 days. I think it was down to $16 or something.
Everything puked, Mike.
Yeah, and it puked, and it immediately V-bottomed out of there. And the next thing you knew, within half a dozen months, it was at 40-something.
Right.
Okay. Well, that spread broke out of a momentum base then that looks actually less impressive than the base we've built now. So we're of the view that you've got to, don't just watch GDX, you got to watch its relationship to the S&P, because that would be further evidence of what? Asset class preference shift. Yeah. People moving money into the gold miners, which as we know are dirt cheap on fundamentals, and getting out of the overpriced stock market. That spread looks like ripe for an upturn, just as it did back in April of 2020, coming off the March lows.
Let me pause that idea real quick, because this thought in my back of my head is people have been in the gold sector. A lot of people will say, well, they love to see the gold miners outperform the metal, and that would help solidify a move up in the metal would be a much better move for the metal. So you want to see the gold miners outperform the metal. that would be the healthiest move.
Now, that's another thing. Yeah.
Yeah. With that must be measured. With this GDX S&P 500 spread you just walked us through, would that be the indicator you'd want to see that spread increase before the gold price move? Would that mean anything to you?
Well, we haven't run it lately, but running the GDX spread versus gold is also informative because there will be a point in this upturn. And we're particularly keen on silver joining gold. We think the miners ultimately, even if they lag just a bit behind gold and silver, which often they do, they'll catch up and then outperform. That's their normal behavior. On a percentage basis, they usually lose more in bear trends. They gain more in uptrends. Mm-hmm. And that's a spread we're watching as well, the relationship between GDX and gold. But likely what's going to happen first is we're going to get silver up out of its quarterly momentum base. And it's clearly defined not just as a momentum structure, but a momentum structure at the three-quarter average itself. Literally, in other words, the zero line for the three-quarter moving average was the point of resistance that halted the rally in November. And if we can get silver to close out a week in the mid-$24 area, we're going to blow that structure out. And we would bet shortly thereafter that silver will, one, start to reassert itself against gold, and the miners will then start to reassert themselves against both of the metals as well. And our preference is silver. On a long-term basis, if we get gold up out of this congestion and we start the next leg up. And I'll remind your viewers that if they'll go back and look at the prior bull markets in gold, go back to the mid-70s. Gold went from $35 an ounce to $200 in 1975. And then look at the other bull markets that followed. They were almost all eightfold moves from bear market low to next bull market peak. Well, our bear market low in 2015 was $1,046. You do the math. So just going to $8,000 would merely be a logarithmic replication of all the prior bull markets we've seen in gold over the last 50 years. So on a relative basis, it wouldn't even be any stronger than those, although price would look, you know, more impressive. We suspect because of the nature of the monetary inflation and the mispricing of other asset categories, stock markets in particular, and government bond markets, that the implosion of those markets is likely to commence soon, the first phase anyway, will be so horrendous and have so many wave effects that the next bull market we see in gold and silver, or the continuation of the one we're in now anyway, will be even more dramatic than merely an eightfold move in gold. And if you'll go back and look where silver's been at various times in relation to gold over the last 50 years, getting up to 3% or more of the price of gold is not uncommon. Well, if gold's at $8,000, you can do the math, okay? Silver would be at levels that are astronomical compared to current, tenfold where they are now. So we favor silver over gold, but we want to see it engage over that quarterly structure. Once we see that, it's green lights as far as we're concerned. We would expect the miners to then fully engage and change tone almost immediately.
Yeah, Mike, I think it might have been last year when we had you on for the first time, and you were talking about, you put those price targets on gold back then. You know, looking back in this year, is there anything about those forecasts that you have been stating that maybe has... Are you surprised it hasn't happened yet? Or are you okay with the how long it has been structurally, has it been working in your way? Because you're, you know, when you put out a number like that in this business, it doesn't come without its critics, right? So,
well, yeah, it doesn't happen tomorrow. Okay. No, I don't think we announced when the March low occurred in gold, that was 1670 was the price low. That was after a 2070 high that occurred in the summer of 2020. Mm-hmm. So if you'll measure that, that's like a 20% correction. It took them 9 months to get a 20% drop out of gold. And it was brief. I mean, you'd stay down there in the 1600s. You immediately went back up to 1900 by May of last year. So you're now living about in the middle of this year and a half range. So it really hasn't been that bloody for gold.
No.
No, it's not. Now, it's been harmful to the miners. They've continued to bleed off.
Right.
Which is an emotional issue, probably largely because of the nature of the investors and the gold miners.
Well, and their input costs have gone up. I mean, the energy has gone up. Their margins are getting cut.
Yeah, that's true. But still, they're doing quite well.
Absolutely, you know, yeah.
Most of them got attuned to $1,000 goals, remember? Mm-hmm. And now we're oscillating below $2,000 goals. So it's quite an improvement from 5 years ago. But all these other asset categories that we're monitoring, like the, we think the dollar is stopped. It's had on monthly momentum of the dollar, it's been rising for well more than a year. And yet it's only gotten back up to 96 level at the recent highs, 96 on the dollar index, which is what? Smack in the middle of one of the dullest six-year price ranges the dollar has ever seen. Mm-hmm. So the best that rally could do, despite all the time they've had to take it up, is get in the middle of the range. And now we've had a sufficient downturn this month for us to label it as now downturning. We're of the view that the dollar, for example, instead of being dull, which it's been for since 2015, by the way, during that time, gold doubled, despite the dollar going sideways. If the dollar gets back down to 90 again, dollar index, and it's traded into the 94s this past week, by the way. So, you know, a 4% drop through last week's low and you're at 90 again. If you get to 90 again, we think dollar is going to assault the lows of the last 50 years. That's down around 70.
Wow.
Well, that would be an event of major proportions in the Forex markets. And if you look at the foreign exchange markets, they've not been volatile for the last 5-6 years, really. They've been extremely narrow. Dollar's been in like a 12% range. So if that category gets violent, the stock market starts to top, muni bonds get in trouble, the central banks are going to go berserk, and they only have one alternative. If gold knows what that is, either give up or go back to do what they normally do. They have no alternative, and gold knows it. And so I think you've got to look at these sideline markets because they're extremely important as inputs for gold. And I think that's why gold has not broken down. Because the people buying gold, hedge fund managers that don't normally buy gold, Dalios of the world, for example,
right,
realize something's wrong out there with that other asset category. And they want to begin to shift assets into a safer area, commodities and gold. And I think they sense what I'm talking about as well, namely the vulnerability of that asset category.
Yeah, there's a couple ideas turning in the back of my head. One is, this all feeds into this relationship that we've continued to have here in the last couple of weeks about the rotation from growth into value. Obviously, this all plays into it. I mean, this is merely anecdotal. You can see it in real time with the data you are just describing. The other idea was, I remember a couple of times, you know, Rick Rule has said it before. It's like, Wall Street has maybe 0.5%, if that, invested into precious metals. You don't need that to go a whole lot higher to make a big move in this sector. Think about it. If they went from 0.5% to even just 0.75%, that'd be a massive move.
It would be a huge wave of money. Yeah, there's no question about it, especially for the gold miners.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people will not, fund managers will not buy bullion, okay, or equivalents. They'll buy the miners. And if you'll notice lately, Newmont's been acting quite well. That's one of the names that large asset managers would likely buy with a sense of safety. You know, it's not a cheap little gold stock. It's a monumental company. And Barrick Gold is also looking like, from a momentum perspective, that it's ready to reengage as an outperformer versus GDX, for example, which is another indication to us that large asset managers are again moving into the larger names. Now, they'll be followed later in an uptrend by the lesser names in the mining sector, which will be chased and will go more ballistic percent-wise. Mm-hmm. But early on, what we want to see is the large asset managers moving into the big names. And we can measure that.
One of the last questions I had for you, Mike, is the idea of sentiment and how it plays into momentum. I don't know if is it a holistic approach, or is there an actual quantitative entry point you can put into your analysis when it comes to momentum that sentiment is playing a key factor in all this?
No, we don't. We can't. We don't measure sentiment. We're not contrarians. Sometimes being a contrarian is a good idea. Like right now, I think it's a good idea to be somewhat of a contrarian about this Fed stuff. It's been going on for 6 months. How come gold isn't collapsing? How come commodities are steady as a rock and near on their highs? Despite 6 months of Fed intimidation, we're going to take commodities down, okay? Well, they're not taking commodities down. They're taking muni bonds down. So that has been an intimidating thing that no doubt has created a lot of negative sentiment among gold investors. And yet, if they'll stand back and look at it, how come the gold market's not collapsing? So there's an example possibly of being a contrarian is a good idea right now. But there are times also when, and we'll see it in the gold trend at some point, where gold will be driving north and a lot of people will be bullish and they'll be right for a year. Remember the dot-com people? They were right for a year. They got real bullish in late 98 and early 99, and it lasted until spring of 2000, that bullish sentiment. So you can't always be a contrarian. So no, we don't measure that.
Yeah. But I mean, I think it was it July of 2020 where you had put out an update that you were concerned that momentum behind the gold price was waning. And that was obviously before it reached those new all-time highs in August.
Well, there were certain momentum events that occurred then that argued correction. And particularly in January of 2021, gold was coming back down through a secondary high at 1900. It got up to the low 1900s again.
Yeah.
And it pulled back in the first week, I think it was in January. And we said, if it hits 1874, I think the number was, watch out. We could get a pretty serious drop. Well, from that point to March, meaning 2 months, it dropped to 1670. And that was based on a quarterly momentum breaking down for gold. But quarterly momentum has now turned positive for gold. It did so in November. It didn't turn positive yet for silver. So we're waiting on that. So quarterly momentum, which is a fairly long-term metric. We also look at annual momentum, which is very long-term. Annual momentum of gold remains positive. Same for silver. It's quarterly momentum that turned down in summer of 2020 and especially January of 21. But it's now turned back up in gold and it's looking ripe for an upturn in silver. And if that turns in silver, as far as we're concerned, it's all green lights. You can just throw a dart at the gold miners. They'll follow. The metals will lead. And probably at that point in time, you're also going to see some of these peripheral markets I've been talking about do further damage to themselves. Stock market, for example, where you'll see coincidental downside.
Mike, how can people find your newsletter?
OliverMSA.com. MSA for Momentum Structural Analysis. I ask for sample. There's a lot of explanatory material on the site discussing what we do, why we do it. We've been around since 1992.
So 30 years. 30 years. Congratulations.
30 years. Yeah. And anyway, it's. I think we're at the most interesting time, not just in my lifetime, but probably in well over a century in terms of financial market dynamics. And it's going to be fun because a lot of reality is going to come back and reassert itself against falsehoods, yeah. False realities, like false pricing, stock prices, for example. So and gold is a place to be, and silver especially.
30 years of MSA, maybe you finally know what you want to do when you grow up, huh?
Yep.
I appreciate your time. There's a lot to take in. Head over to Momentum Structural Analysis. I have been reading this newsletter, like I said, for greater part of the year. It does take a little bit of a learning curve, but honestly, two or three reads, you completely understand what Mike is talking about, and you want to open up and read it every time it hits the inbox. So Mike, from a fellow Coloradan to yourself, enjoy the warmer weather until the next snow flies.
Yeah, certainly warmer here now than the East Coast.
Yes, it certainly is, but it may not be for long.
No. So, Thanks, Trevor.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with some more Mining Stock Daily. We're back here on our second segment of our Friday long-form interview here on Mining Stock Daily, welcoming back one of the OGs of MSD. He is one of the godfathers here for Mining Stock Daily, somebody who actually has supported this podcast since almost day one. I'm forever grateful to for his input and advice. But also, I'm also grateful because I'm a happy shareholder of his company. And that is the president of Monera Alamos, Mr. Doug Ramshaw. Hey, Doug, welcome back.
Hey, Trevor. Good to be back. And a nice disclosure of your position just segued into that intro. So we got that out of the way. I should do my forward-looking statements now, and then we're all good to go.
Yeah, I tell you what, if you've been following me on the podcast or on Twitter for the last 3.5 years and you don't understand I'm a shareholder of Monera, you have not been really paying attention.
Yeah. Oh, well, how's the year started for you?
You know what? The year's been great. I got to say, a lot of content coming out. Obviously, the price in the metals continues to improve, and there's a little bit of breadth in not only the miners, but also the juniors and developers. We also launched a Substack, so the Substack's going well and getting a lot of good compliments and constructive criticism on that. So it's been a great year. But we're not here to talk about me, Doug. We're here to talk about you.
Well, you're the better interviewer as well, so that's my sole question.
Okay, thanks. We got listen, 2022 is looking to be, I don't know if transformative year is the right word, a catalyst of a year, perhaps. It's going to be an important year for the company because, listen, you announced you've had first gold pour from the Santana project. Now, that doesn't mean you've reached commercial production. That is still kind of in limbo and discussion here. So let's talk about Santana first, and then we'll get to where the other projects within the portfolio stand. You know you can produce gold, but mm-hmm. you haven't yet announced commercial production. Why is that?
Well, I mean, we're still in the ramp-up phase. I mean, we're also cognizant, and I'm not going to name names here, but I mean, there's some pretty clear examples in the marketplace of companies that have made commercial production declarations. And I mean, it might be unfair of me to say it, but they almost feel like they're promotional statements, you know, and yes, by definition, you know, say if you're a milling operation and you're running a, I don't know, 1,000-ton-a-day mill, if you get up to 80% of that nameplate capacity for 45 or 60 days, it's like, oh, checkmark, commercial production declaration follows. And the mill's just one part of a deposit, or for us, a leach cycle is just one part of the deposit. You need to have multiple metrics, which are all jiving, you know, because ultimately, if you're going to say we have a commercial operation, short of a collapse in commodity prices, you really should be sending the message to the market, we run a profitable operation, we're making money, whether maybe it's at the operations level, if you've got some crazy, you know, high corporate overhead, which we don't. But I think that's what supports a statement like that. And for that, and for us, the leach cycle is going great. You know, so on that metric, I think we could have announced, you know, now probably, or even towards the end of last year, because leaching was fine. But there were other parts of the deposit where it was like our goal for Santana, say, is our mining rate, along with that leach cycle, I think we were targeting in the early, you know, for the startup phase of operations there, about 10,000 tons a day. We're at 7,000 or 8,000 tons a day. You know, now 7,000 or 8,000 tons a day with our leach cycle, can we make money? Yes. So could you make that declaration? Probably. But at the same time, it's not where we forecast, you know, it's not our definition of it. And so we're working through getting the mining rate up to align with the leach cycle. We've had, you know, perhaps it's a champagne problem, but we have, we do crush material, coarse crush, that's over 0.5 gram, I think, is our cutoff for crushing. And early days, our biggest bottleneck has been, we've had a lot of that material. You know, and so, you know, is the crushing capacity quite there yet? These are all things that this, you know, over the next month or so will align. And we actually took some time and a break over Christmas to kind of analyze where those bottlenecks were so that when we're ready to make that announcement, we're making it in good faith. knowing that we have come out of ramp up and we are now a new commercial gold mine. So I for us, the most important thing was the leach cycle, because that can be the Achilles heel for open pit. So that got addressed very early on. And I always said to Darren, if mining rate's slightly behind, I don't really care, but you can't necessarily fix leach kinetics. So we're very, very happy on the metallurgy.
So you're really approaching this as a balancing act. You're trying to get everything laid out there, de-risking as you go here, even through before you announce that commercial production. Because things change. I mean, obviously, we see it all the time. Because you're right, we have seen a number of companies announce commercial production. And then once they're actually mining and producing, it's typically something from the processing side of things that causes an issue. And then they got to put out a new release saying, things are screwed up.
Yeah. And I think you only have one chance to do things right. And we're all about doing it right. And if it's slow and methodical, but done correctly, then that's the path I always take. I've seen people talk about how typically after a company achieves production, there's a drop in their share price thereafter. And I think to a large extent, it's because there is all that hype and leading into that commercial production decision, but then the problems come thereafter. I would rather have a slow and steady approach and eliminate as many of the problems, especially during the ramp up period. That's what you use that period to make sure that everything is aligned. And, Darren told me very early on, before we even had the permits at Santana, let alone built it, that, every mine he's built has been successful, and yet everyone has had teething problems. And to me, the key is use the ramp up period to get through any little teething problems you might have, so that you're really starting as you mean to go forward.
Would a raging gold price have any sort of influence on this decision with you? I mean, wouldn't you feel a little bit challenged to try to get up to announcement of a commercial production as, say, gold is back over 1950 or something like that?
No. I mean, just like I'm sure there are a whole bunch of companies dusting off any kind of draft news release now to get it out in a week where gold is doing well. No, we'll not be reactive to the market. We'll be proactive to the business plan.
Do you feel like shareholders would think otherwise?
No, I don't think so. I think our shareholders that have come along for the ride and stayed very loyal to this story appreciate and understand our approach. And I think sleep well at night as a result. So, I would like to think that we've transcended the ranks of companies that feel the need to make news. And sometimes it's making news for the sake of a news release. And that's a nice place to be. We'll never be reactive to market conditions.
So very important year for Santana. Walk us through somewhat of the strategy in 2022 for the other projects within the portfolio.
Yeah, it's a pivotal year. You use transformative. I mean, they're all one and the same, really. All eyes are going to be on Santana, absolutely, and rightly so, as our first producing mine. But our business model and what I've presented to the market over the last few years has always been, what makes us different from a typical junior producer is we can build a sequence of mines with very low capex and bring them on in a very timely manner. So this year, alongside Santana, we kind of really can unveil exactly how that's going to play out. Hoping in February, That's my guess is in February. I mean, it's all fluid, but I hate that word. But hopefully in February, we'll have all our surface rights agreements tied up for our second, what should be our second mine, Cerro de Oro in northern Zacatecas. And the moment we have the surface rights, which is really our initial starting kind of social license with the community, we can start not only talking about the drilling we're going to do there and the additional met work and all the planning ahead of receipt of permits and a construction decision, but also, you know, you need those surface rights to submit the permit applications. And we've got the permits applications ready to go. So all being well, in this first quarter, we'll get those permit applications in, and hopefully around year end, we can see permits back for Cerro de Oro. And it's only, we're estimating about a 5 to 6 month construction time. So, you know, this unveiling of a multi-mine, quick build, low capex build model, you know, really is going to be shown for what it is this year, because Cerro de Oro could come on stream second half of 2023. And that coupled with Santana should immediately take us, you know, once it's gone through ramp up through the plus 100,000 ounce a year producer range, with Fortuna waiting in the wings, and it's 50,000 ounces that it could contribute. And the fact that all of these projects maybe start out as anywhere between 40 and 60,000 ounce a year operations. But we know from our bootstrapping approach that as we expand resources, we can expand those production profiles. But it all starts with us showing the path to the second mine. So that's, I think, going to be great this year. It's going to provide a lot of news flow, as well as really underscoring the business model that I've been trumpeting for the last couple of years.
Okay. And what about La Fortuna? Where does that stand?
Well, it's fully permitted. sitting there, nice 3.5, 4 gram open pit, fantastic economics from the 2018 PEA. I mean, it's a sub $500 an ounce gold deposit. Again, limited capex, sub $30 million to build. But it's if there's one knock against it, is the PEA was based around a high-grade five-year starter pit. And no one should like a five-year mine life. We want to see all our operations be at least, you know, 7 to 8 years. And then as we expand resources, we can expand production profiles and not necessarily at the expense of mine life, but getting them up to 7 to 8 years so you can get appropriate multiples on your cash flow and the like. So to me, San, you know, Fortuna being pushed back just will allow us time and a bigger operation, fully utilizing the mill that we already own for it. And giving the exploration excitement to our story, which I love exploration. I've said to you before, I just hate the cost of it. So, you know, I see free cash from our first operations being very much reinvested in the growth of the business model by defining more ounces at Santana, at Cerro de Oro, and also at Fortuna. And the nice thing about that kind of exploration is it hasn't cost you anything other than the redeployment of cash flow. When, you know, we shouldn't be going out doing equity raises to do another drill program and another drill program. That's the beauty of getting Santana up and running. It kind of gets us off that hamster wheel of constantly worrying about where the next money's coming from.
That's actually a good pivot to one of the bigger conversations outside of, you said, pivotal year for the company. I think it's absolutely right. It was a really interesting couple months here for Minera Alamos due to a relationship that you had with one of the key shareholders of the company. That was Osisko Development. They had been long supporters of the company. But, you know, sometimes the equity markets can be foretelling. And I don't know how much they had unloaded, but it was blocks and blocks of up to, what was it, 40 million shares, 50 million shares in total?
Oh, they and I'll say right off the top, you're right. They were early supporters of us, and I don't think was really indicative of us. Mr. Rusin in the Q3 called what a great team we are, and they're very supportive of us. I think it was more that a Cisco development that spun out of a Cisco Royalties, our early backer, that has allowed us to be the company we are today, and I'll never take that away from their efforts to support us. Cisco development had a bunch of cash, but they also had a bunch of equity investments put into it as well from OR when they spun that out. And we were a very key part of that equity book. When you're a developer, we've done the same with the Prime Mining stock that we owned in Monero. We're not investment vehicles. No one's getting 2 and 20 for performance of investment holdings in a company. We should be looking at how we can use equity holdings we might have inherited, and see how they can be turned into cash to invest in our business, not be passive holders of someone else's business. And a Cisco developed Caribou project, San Antonio in Mexico. So I think it was more a function of them needing cash than anything else. And they liquidated a bunch at the end of last year, in the last few months of last year, and it did create a lot of disorder in our market, and it was unfortunate how it was done, to be perfectly honest. But I worked with our bankers who had clarity on where there were potential buyers for a block like that, that was would allow new shareholders to get positioned for the upcoming years. And we built a shadow book of interest so that we could pitch them on just buying out the rest of the block, and we completed that on the second trading day of this year. So now I can't blame that selling as a reason for our stock not going up. So I've either got to come up with new excuses or just put my head down and at least know we don't actually have that artificial overhang on the stock. And I'm happy for them, happy for us, happy for our shareholders. But I know it's been a frustrating time for a lot of people, including myself. I'm glad that we were able to rip that Band-Aid off day two of the year.
But this part of the business, Doug, it's not always pretty. And I'm just wondering, and I hope you can be as candid as you possibly can. Because me as a shareholder, when I was watching this, all I could think was, this is not the way it could have been done. It could have been handled much more eloquently between Osisko Development and Minera Alamos. If you're going to put up a huge block like that, it just doesn't seem like there was a great communication between the two of you that that's what they wanted to do. Which, of course, it's their right to do it. What they do with their equity positions, it's totally up to them. But how they do it, I think there's a right and a wrong way. Is that fair to say?
I think we'd outgrown the relationship, so I think that there can be a nice, gracious parting of ways. If you, in my, I mean, the reality of the situation was when we crossed the last of it out, it was a $20 million book of business, really, that our bankers and myself put together to take it out. I'm not sure, and maybe this is where Osisko felt. Until we came with a wholesome offer for all of it, they were going to continue to dribble it out, which is what they did over 3 months. And I mean, the reality was, because they'd offloaded 35 million shares, by the time we were going to them for the last 41, the dollar number on it was about $20 million of business. If they needed to sell earlier, maybe it was going to be a tougher, I mean, the last quarter of last year was not a friendly quarter. Now imagine you're trying to build a book of $38 million worth of business at a time where we hadn't come out with, some of the operating news out of the startup. It would have been, so whilst I was very frustrated with how it was done, that created a lot of disorder in our market, which was the thing that bothered me most. And I felt like how the selling took place could have shaken out loyal shareholders. Unfortunately, the probably were, that it was that kind of stuff that bothered me about it. But I mean, in reality, I think, it served their purpose and ultimately allowed us to build a solid book of $20 million to take out their remaining block early this year. And it's done. It's rear view mirror stuff. A good friend of both yours and mine, you know, I know commented, it's kind of circle of life stuff. So I get Lion King in my head right now. But, you know, in the early days, the Cisco were there and funded us. And in many ways, you know, the success of our equity, we've repaid that early support by helping their funding. That's a nice way, at least, to exit. And yeah, I was certainly frustrated about it. I didn't hold back on a couple of tweets either. But overall, you know, I think we can all look back at it and say, you know, it was a great relationship. And now we're looking forward to the new owners of their stock benefiting from the next phase of the company's development, that of this multi-mine gold producer, as opposed to the permitter and developer that we were on, you know, when Osisko was shareholders.
Doug, I think there were a couple of things throughout that time late last year that really stood out. Despite the challenges and that you were going through in managing the equity of the company, there's two things. One, you were a ferocious buyer. You just kept, I don't even know how much stock you bought during that time, but it was quite a bit. So you played your part, which I think is what any investor, speculator in this space wants to see, is a management team that will buy their stock as best they can when times are tough. Second thing that really stood out is really the strength of the shareholder base for Minera. And there was, I didn't see anybody out there wanting to crucify Minera for this whole thing. They were really upset with ODEV, and they were willing to come in and buy as much as those, whether it was a couple thousands of shares of those blocks or entire blocks or whatever. Like, I really think it was a testament to the strength of the shareholder base of Minera Alamos due to your honesty, integrity, and just being truthful with the expectations of the company over the last 3 years.
We're very lucky with our shareholders, and I know I'm very grateful for that, but I'm also, that's why I'm going to go to bat for them. And maybe that's why I tweeted a couple of things that I did. And in fairness, it was other people that were venting at Cisco, and maybe it was a little unfair, some of the attacks that they were having. Really, if everyone knew everything behind the curtains, I think some of it was unfair. It created a great opportunity. I've always said that I want to own more stock. I believe that it is very important to be properly aligned with your existing shareholders and potential new shareholders. So yeah, I dropped probably more money than I care to mention in that last 3 months doing my bit. And I'll continue to do that, because I'm a big believer in our company, and I want to own more. And so I always tell people, don't worry about when I'm buying, at what price or whatever. It's nothing more indicative than I found some money somewhere, either down the back of a couch in a broker's account. And where do I tend to put it? I put it into my own, I eat my own cooking in that regard. So, and I'm still playing catch up with Darren. So that's my ultimate goal there. But yeah, I think it's really important to send a message as management. And I'm glad I did that. The thing that probably got me more than anything else was, I really don't care if you're a 76 million shareholder or a 76,000 shareholder. They're all equally important to me, because it is our shareholders at large that allow us to do what we do and have a passion for. And for that, we're truly grateful. And if it's an exiting shareholder, they become less important to me and have no importance to me when they're out of their position. The people that buy their stock are the ones that now are important on a go forward basis. And so, you know, I'm glad it was all largely done in 2021. We can look forward to a very positive year for the company now with a cloud removed.
I am going to tease you a little bit. If you're telling people it's just money you found on your couch, then your couch must be nicknamed Dixie, and that corner of that couch should be the LP.
I'm a big guy. It's a big couch. No, I, Yeah, I mean that it's certainly all my stock is locked up until after that Great Bear transaction closes. So this was other money that I now we as management we signed lockup agreements for that. So I can't touch that yet.
Yeah. Well, speaking of locked up, I'm hoping you can let Chris Taylor out sometime. You know, we'd love to talk to him.
Yeah, no, I'm going to be responsible with that. I've always said it's been that was one hell of a ride. Yeah, no, I know, here's the big difference and why I'm going to be really proud of what we do with Monero. I'm very proud of my involvement with Great Bear. We were a very active board, and it was a 5.5 year run. And I'll miss it because I'll miss the team. I'll miss everything we achieved in that. But it was also Chris Taylor and Bob Singh's show. It doesn't matter how engaged we were as a board and supportive as a board. And in many ways, Monero is my magnum opus. So, you know, it's just one less distraction now. And, you know, it was a very pleasant distraction, but now, you know, full focus Monero and what we're going to do to make our own billion-dollar company ourselves, hopefully as a gold producer, as opposed to Great Bear, obviously making an incredible exploration discovery.
Looking forward to that success. Doug, it's a pleasure to have you back here on the podcast. And, you know, we'll probably catch up with you again here maybe this spring or if not sooner. But until then, be well. All the best to you and the family.
Thanks for having me on, Trevor. Good to be here.
It's Doug Ramshaw, president of Monero Alamos, trading on the TSX with the symbol MAI. I'm a shareholder. They're also coming back on as a sponsor this year on Mining Stock Daily, so we look forward to talking with them frequently throughout the year. That's a wrap here for us here this week on Mining Stock Daily. We'll be back Monday morning with the news briefing. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. Be well. The information presented should not be considered investment advice. Mining Stock Daily and its affiliates are not responsible for any loss arising from any investment decision in connection with the material presented herein. Please do your own research or speak with a licensed financial representative before making any investment decision.